your online community for positive change. Seventh Wave Network.
Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dream. The one they picked, the one you know by.
Welcome to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education, with your hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis. This program will give parents and educators the skills and methods to effectively advocate for children today. And now, here's Rich and Michelle.
Hello everyone, this is Rich Weinfeld.
And this is Michelle Davis. Welcome to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education. This is a show dedicated to exploring issues in schools that can make the difference between what we are and what we could be as a society. Rich and I believe that with high expectations and with an education system that works, all children can achieve. If you have children and you're listening, you'll learn how to partner with the school to advocate for your child in a powerful and effective way. And if you're an educator listening to the show, we'll advance your skills and knowledge to really make that additional positive change in other educators and school communities. And today we have a very exciting topic that Rich will help us to understand.
Today's show is called Does One Size Really Fit All? And I'll tell you a little bit about what the show today will be about. How does our education system meet the needs of all children? How do we teach our children with special needs and special gifts and talents to help each child learn to her best ability? Is inclusion really the best way to go, and under what conditions can it work? Some students need special classes or programs in order to get an appropriate level of challenge or support. And how do federal policies such as No Child Left Behind affect our kids with special needs, including those with gifts and talents? We have a wonderful guest today, Dr. Mary Ruth Coleman, who is the past president of the Council for Exceptional Children, which is the vision and voice of children with special needs. And she will address these issues with us. Before we introduce Mary Ruth, we'd like to start the show talking about some of the current hot topics in education. Last week we had Mark Beatty with us from the Twice Exceptional newsletter to bring us up to date on some topics. Mark has again contributed some topics to us today that we'll discuss, and Michelle and I have also done our own digging, and we have some topics that we feel are important to discuss with you today. A lot of the advocacy groups are calling for May 6th to be a call-in day to your congressional representatives in an effort to get one or both of two new laws passed that will reinstate the payment for expert witness fees for parents. The background of this is what happened in a Supreme Court decision in 2006 is that the Supreme Court denied parents the right to reimbursement for their expert witness fees. Congressman Chris Van Hollen, along with Pete Sessions of Maryland and Texas, respectively, have introduced a bipartisan IDEA Fairness Restoration Act. Also in the Senate, there has been a bill introduced by Senator Ted Kennedy, along with Congressman John Lewis, I guess it's both in the Senate and the House, that is the Civil Rights Act of 2008 that also includes a measure that would override the decision in Murphy. And Michelle and I wanted to kick off the show by discussing why we think this is so important. And I know, Michelle, you've had some involvement in this, and I'd like to hear your thoughts.
This is such an important issue because one of the most powerful ways that parents have to dispute with the school districts and to get a judge to make a decision is called a due process hearing. And this is doubly important because we're now on the heels of a Supreme Court decision, Schaefer versus Wiest, where whoever files for a due process hearing, mostly parents, now have the burden to prove that they are right. And in order to prove that they're right, parents need experts. And parents cannot readily, most of the time, afford experts, while the school districts are laden with experts, and from educators to administrators to psychologists, and it really makes an uneven playing field for parents, especially parents in the socioeconomic status brackets that cannot afford to just go out and hire their own experts. I have personal experience with this, where kids have not gotten what they needed because the parents could not afford to go to a due process hearing with the appropriate level of expertise.
I have a couple statistics here. Approximately 36% of children with disabilities live in families earning less than $25,000 a year, families less than $25,000. Over two-thirds live in families that earn less than $50,000 a year. So, again, when you think about the large expense of paying for your own experts versus a school system who already employs those experts, it really is a fairness issue. I was able to talk to Sarah Schnelling, who is the legislative assistant for Congressman Van Hollen, who focuses on education. And you know, I asked her, you know, why is Congressman Van Hollen behind this? Why does he care about it? And she the first thing she said is, this is a fairness issue. It makes the playing field unfair right now by putting all the burden on the parents and expecting them to have the resources to hire these experts.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the overall goal of our show is to really set forth the idea that children are our best natural resource, and we need to teach them well and create an education system that works and that's equitable to develop these future leaders. That's so important.
You know, the other thing I think is important to bring out is, when we talk about parents being able to hire experts for due process hearings, it sounds like we're advocating more due process hearings. And again, another statistic that I think is very important to share: in 2003, the General Accounting Office of the government did a study. There were only 5 due process hearings per 10,000 special ed students. So we're not talking about something that happens frequently, but what we're talking about is making it fair when it does happen. And I know Michelle and I both do advocacy work. You know, my experience is that without the threat of possible due process to move things along, sometimes things will not move. So it's important, even though in most cases we hope we don't go to due process, most cases won't go to due process, but it's important for everyone to know that that is really available. And without this fairness in expert witnesses, it's not truly available for those who can't afford it.
Well, I really like the trend of bringing cases, you know, up the higher level courts, and, you know, having Congress and Senate really involved in education issues. It's very encouraging. Shall we move on to some other hot topics?
Yeah, what else do you have?
Well, speaking of bills and Senate bills, we've got out of several different states anti-bullying bills. Bullying and teasing in schools is a really hot topic, and out of the Boston Globe, we've got an article which enumerates the 1-2-3-page guide for Department of Public Health, which is the prevention of bullying, and, you know, the goal is to dispel the myths that bullies have low self-esteem, that bullying is just a part of childhood, and that victims often overreact to taunting. And this is a very, very important issue, as we know, can lead to some devastating results when kids who are bullied and there are not interventions can really make very poor choices that hurt other people.
This is a hot topic. You know, everywhere that I go, you know, various conferences that I attend, it's a topic people want to know more about what to do. We're going to have a show July 11th, our own show specifically dedicated to that. And then when I look at a couple of our other shows, our show on Asperger's syndrome and other autism-related disorders certainly will touch on that. And that's June 20th, and our show on June 13th, focusing on gender in our schools, meeting the needs of our sons and daughters, will certainly touch on that too. It's, you know, it's an issue that really permeates a lot of other issues.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, over half of the states are now addressing this. If Chris signs this bill, Florida would become the 36th state in the nation with an actual law prohibiting bullying and harassment. So I hope that the rest of the nation follows suit.
That's great. That's great. Well, why don't you, I know you have several other hot topics. Why don't you run down at least headlines of some of the other hot topics?
Well, if you're a parent paying college tuition, you'll be interested in the USA Today article titled "Value of College Tuition is Called into Question," and it talks about how we're not getting the bang for our buck. I mean, we pay in the United States the most high level of college tuition, and not only are our graduates not being employed, but they're not getting paid commensurate with what we've paid out. Also, I thought it was very interesting that the American Heart Association had recently suggested that children diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, receive heart tests before they're given stimulant drugs. And this is because between 1999 and 2004, the FDA reported 26 children suffering strokes, cardiac arrests, or heart palpitations, and 19 children actually died. So there's a lot more attention being paid, I think, to ADHD itself and the medication pros and cons, which, of course, Rich and I deal with on almost a daily basis.
I was going to say that would be a topic for a show unto itself. It's such a tough issue for parents to decide whether or not, you know, to decide along with their doctors, to decide whether or not medication is appropriate. You know, we certainly have seen many cases where it's very helpful for kids, but we also have seen cases where rather than look at other positive school interventions, the first thing that folks think about is, you know, we need to medicate. So it's certainly an issue with lots of pros and cons and a very tough individual decision, and I'm sure hearing about the risks of heart problems makes it even a tougher decision.
Absolutely. And before we get ready to go to a brief break and then bring back on Dr. Mary Ruth Coleman as our guest for today, we want to remind people to email us and call us. The email is specialneedsadvocacy@msn.com. Again, specialneedsadvocacy@msn.com. Send us an email. A question for Dr. Mary Ruth Coleman or related to any of the topics we're talking about or any other hot topics that you want to express yourself in the area of education. And I guess lastly, there's a lot of discussion about school choice these days, and vouchers and special education are working in many states, and that is an article out of the Washington Times, April 29th.
And I'll just remind, we have two free subscriptions to the 2E newsletter for our first two callers today. So please call in with your thoughts. Be back after the break.
They see the truth.
You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Are you paying too much for term life insurance? There's a price war among the major term life carriers. Consider these possible rates. A man age 45, non-tobacco user, could obtain $1 million of coverage for as little as $75 a month, and this rate is fixed for the next 10 years. We specialize in policies of $500,000 and above. A man age 50, non-tobacco user, may be able to obtain $500,000 of coverage for as little as $115 per month, and this rate is fixed for the next 20 years. That's right, guaranteed not to change for 20 years. We have great rates for smokers too. For new or replacement term life insurance, call the Term Lifeline now. 800-890-5075. 800-890-5075. That's 800-890-5075.
How can we be powerful advocates for the children in our lives? How do we ensure that they're getting the best education possible? The Special Needs Advocacy Training Institute prepares parents and educators to be outstanding advocates for school success. The Training Institute is based on Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis's Special Needs Advocacy Resource Book. The book is comprehensive, practical, and easy to read. Visit specialneedsadvocacyinstitute.com to learn more about this dynamic training opportunity. Parents, are you concerned with your child's progress at school? Educators educators. Do you wish that you could do more for your class? Are you interested in pursuing a career in educational advocacy? At SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com, you'll learn how to make a difference in the lives of children. You will also find information about Rich and Michelle's consulting and advocacy services. Our children need powerful advocates to ensure that they're getting an appropriate education. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn what you can do to more effectively advocate for the children in your life.
A fresh look at today's health. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Teach your children well.
You're listening to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education with hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or tip regarding today's topic, give us a call toll-free at 866-472-5792. That number again is 866-472-5792. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education. I'm your co-host, Michelle Davis, and our other co-host, Rich Weinfeld, is here too. We are very fortunate today to have with us a very special guest, Dr. Mary Ruth Coleman. And Mary Ruth is a senior research scientist at the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And I absolutely love that I get to say that Mary Ruth is an education leader who is also a scientist, because we're going to be talking about how important it is to have scientifically based and data-driven methodologies happening in the classroom. But Mary Ruth has spent her entire life dedicated to the field of education. Dr. Coleman not only conducts research at the Child Development Institute at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, but she's also had numerous publications, including the textbook Teaching Exceptional Children by Kirk Gallagher and others. And she has put together two issues of the Journal of Education of the Gifted, specifically targeting educating and parenting gifted girls and women, and targeting the underserved gifted population. And Mary Ruth has not only been very proficient in her career in working with giftedness, but also with the other spectrum of special needs, which is special education and students with disabilities. When she was teaching, she was both a general educator and a special educator, and she has been in too many for me to list here, research projects and special projects where she has contributed and lectured all around the globe. Two of her projects at this point include U-STARS Plus, Using Science Talents and Abilities to Recognize, STUD, and you'll have to tell us what that is, and then Recognizing and Response Observation and Rating Scales Manual. So, Dr. Coleman, thank you very much for being here with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really fun, and it's really fun to be back working with you guys again.
Thanks for being here, Mary Ruth.
Mary Ruth, you know, the U.S. Department of Education puts out a What Works Clearinghouse, and this is supposed to be a conglomeration of scientifically based and research-based types of topics, issues, and methods that educators can use. As I look at the top 10 responses to the question, what topics should the What Works Clearinghouse study, number 10, it made it into the top 10, is response to intervention. So can you tell us a little bit about what response to intervention is, and why is it important to the Department of Education and the field of education in general?
Well, it's interesting. Response to intervention has kind of taken the field and taken the world by storm in the last few years. And it's actually an approach to bringing evidence-based and scientifically-based research into the classroom as a strong platform for helping us make sure that children are taught well, and that when children continue to struggle or continue to meet with challenges, even when they're in optimal learning conditions, we can watch how they respond to scientifically-based instruction and practices. And by their responses, we can determine if we need to provide additional support and additional help and services for them. So So response intervention, and it's sometimes called responsiveness to instruction, is a systematic approach to using data on what students are doing and what students are capable of doing, and monitoring how students are making progress in the instructional practices that we're using, and by monitoring their progress, being able to quickly ratchet up support, provide additional services, or intervene when students are meeting with challenges. I think key components that we're seeing, and by the way, there's no one way to implement RTI right now. It's an emerging practice, so different people are implementing it in different ways. But most of the people that are involved with RTI would say, I think, that these are key aspects or key components. The first key components gets back to your original question, Michelle, and that's about evidence-based practices. Now, I'm going to come back to that because you actually said scientifically based, so maybe we can tease that apart a little bit. But first key component of RTI is evidence-based instructional practices. The second key component is a hierarchical arrangement of supports and services so that as the need of the child increases, our supports and services that we provide can increase to meet that need for that child. So a hierarchical arrangement of supports and services. The third is taking a look at comprehensive assessments and progress monitoring data to make sure that we really understand what the child's strengths are, what the child's needs are, and what the child's challenges are, and that we don't do that just once a year or at the end of the year or at the beginning of the year. We actually do that as we're teaching so that we can modify our instruction if we aren't meeting with success with this child.
That's a beautiful summary of the response to intervention, and as I stated before, you are one of the only education leaders who I've known to be a senior research scientist, and that's exciting because we get to talk to you about evidence-based practices and scientifically based methods. You said you wanted to tease that out a little bit.
Well, feel free. It's interesting because sometimes they're used as synonyms. So you'll hear people talk about scientifically based practice and evidence-based practice as though they're the same thing. But what we actually are meaning when we say evidence-based practice is that there are three sources of evidence base that says this practice works with children. One source is the scientific and theoretical, the research base. So that research base that over the years accumulates to say we see through our research with children and classrooms and teachers that this particular practice of reading approach, guided reading, for example, has a strong research base that says this will work with children as we teach them to read. So scientific base or research base is one component of an evidence base. But there are two others that may be of high interest to your reader, to your listeners. The second one is practitioner wisdom. Teachers have taught for many, many years. They use curriculum, they use standards, they use practices, and when they see that these work with their students, that wisdom around their students' needs and the practices that they have used that have worked contributes to the evidence base. It's like a third leg of a three-legged stool.
Mm-hmm.
And that third leg, it's the second leg, and the third leg of the three-legged stool is family values. Because just because a teacher says, I think this will work, and a research study says, oh yeah, we've seen it work, that particular practice with a particular child may still not be appropriate because the family may not feel like it's the right thing to do with their child. So evidence base is a three-legged stool. Research or scientific evidence is one leg. Practitioner wisdom and experience is a second leg. And family values is a third leg. And when all of those come together, then we would think we'd have optimal supports and services designed for a child.
How do we get from here to there? And, you know, how do we we have such an unevenness in our schools across the country, and a lot of struggling schools.
Yeah.
And what you're saying, sounds wonderful, but how do we make it happen in the classroom?
Well, I think RTI is actually a first step because it is a systematic approach to saying that we must begin looking at these issues. But you're right, Rich. I mean, we are a long way from being able to say that we have quality, what would be considered the first tier of the hierarchy in RTI, which is the general classroom tier, where we can say that across the schools in the country, schools in economically disadvantaged areas, schools in inner cities, schools in rural areas sometimes do not have the resources allocated in a way that allows teacher quality to come through and teacher practice to be based on evidence base. The What Works Clearinghouse that Michelle mentioned, that's just a fabulous first start, because that gives us at least a sense of what practices have a scientific or a research base. And then looking at the national standards to see which practices tie in with practitioner wisdom and the national content standards in science and math and other areas give us a good sense of what practitioners feel from working for many years are key components of the curriculum we should be teaching. And then I think teacher preparation is very, very critical, and finding ways to do the collaborative problem solving that's a key component of RTI that brings parents in so we actively listen.
I think that's such an important component. You know, in my day-to-day work, I hear a lot about research-based methods and methodologies, and even if a school has the ability to put into place some of the reading programs, for example, there's not a lot of research out there. I mean, that's what I found, you know, that the publishers of a reading program might research their own program, but in terms of independent research about what actually works for specific types of either, you know, reading or behavior interventions, have you found that there is a deficit in this area?
And if I could piggyback, I think reading is probably more research than written language or, you know, or some of the other areas.
That's right. And both of you, I mean, you're right on target. I mean, there is one of the things that I hope the evidence-based practice studies and the What Works Clearinghouse kinds of studies will do is point out where the gaps are, where we just don't have any research base, or we have a very emerging research base for a variety of practices. So I think this holds a great promise for policy. So we can say, you know, we have a fair amount of reading research, but we don't have much on math, particularly math for kids with disabilities, or we have an emerging research base on that. And so when we find these gaps, Michelle, what we have to try to do is fill them, and we have to try to direct the Institute for Educational Sciences to call for research on these areas and fund the research on these areas. So it's a complex issue.
That's exactly right. And Mary Ruth, thank you so much. We'll be right back after a break. And be sure to email us, specialneedsadvocacy@msn.com.
Your life, your health, your network. Voice America Health and Wellness.
How can we be powerful advocates for the children in our lives? How do we ensure that they're getting the best education possible? The Special Needs Advocacy Training Institute prepares parents and educators to be outstanding advocates for school success. The Training Institute is based on Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis's Special Needs Advocacy Resource Book. The book is comprehensive, practical, and easy to read. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn more about this dynamic training opportunity. Parents, are you concerned with your child's progress at school? Educators, do you wish that you could do more for your class? Are you interested in pursuing a career in educational advocacy? At SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com, you'll learn how to make a difference in the lives of children. You will also find information about Rich and Michelle's consulting and advocacy services. Our children need powerful advocates to ensure that they're getting an appropriate education. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn what you can do to more effectively advocate for the children in your life.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared. It's like tiny nails in the air poke my lungs. I start to cough.
Did you know your child's asthma attacks can be triggered by things like shower curtains, a blanket, even a teddy bear?
I feel like I'm choking.
And there are many other things in your home and your child's classroom you may not know about. For the latest information, call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS.
Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
Help prevent your child's asthma attacks and avoid the emergency room. Call toll-free 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. That's 1-866-662-8822. Or visit www.noattacks.org.
I don't want to feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA and the Ad Council.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Teach your children well.
You're listening to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education with hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or tip regarding today's topic, give us a call toll-free at 866-472-5792. That number again is 866-472-5792. Now, back to the program.
Hi, this is Rich Weinfeld with my co-host Michelle Davis, and we're very honored and excited to have Dr. Mary Ruth Coleman with us today, and we're going to jump right back in with some more questions. Mary Ruth, there has been a growing move, and I think it's a nationwide trend, towards more inclusion, having special needs, special education students in general ed classes to a greater extent. What do you think is motivating this move?
Well, I think one of the things that is clearly at play here is that we have a growing acceptance and understanding that individuals who have special needs or have exceptionalities are people first. And so they deserve, need, and require access to the kinds of opportunities that are provided for all individuals to learn, to grow, to develop social habits, to interact, and to have access to the best possible curriculum. So I think we're seeing a growing acceptance societally of differences across people and within people. And I think that that's wonderful that we are seeing this acceptance increase.
So it sounds like you feel it's positive and it is in the best interest of kids. Am I reading you accurately?
Well, you're reading me accurately that a growing acceptance of differences is really positive, and that working to meet the needs of children, be they social needs, educational needs, emotional needs, within a natural context and within a context where people live, where people attend school, where people work, is optimal. Now, having said that, within that context of a general classroom, when we're talking about academic needs, what we have to remember is that unless we provide appropriate supports and services in addition to just a classroom teacher, then the needs of that child may not be fully addressed. So while including the child in our general education classrooms and our general education curriculum and giving access to typically developing children is optimal, we have to remember that within that setting, our students will need some additional supports and services, and there are times where it's very appropriate to provide additional supports and services outside of the general classroom as well.
And some of folks who may be a little more cynical, which maybe I'll include myself in, believe that some of the motivations for the movement towards more inclusion have to do with things like budgetary constraints, that it's less expensive to educate kids in the general ed classes. Also, No Child Left Behind seems to be a big driver in that the requirement for highly qualified educators in content areas. It's hard to find special educators who are also highly qualified in content areas. Could you speak to those maybe more cynical pieces of the inclusion?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I guess we should define inclusion. So are we talking about full inclusion without any additional supports and services, without any related services like speech language, without special education support and service? If we're talking about full inclusion as saying, well, let's just dump everybody in a room, stir the pot, and let them go, then that clearly is not going to work. But if inclusion is done well and done correctly, We can even almost go back to that RTI that we talked about earlier. It will have that hierarchical organization of supports and services where special and general educators and related service providers collaborate in a multidisciplinary approach to ensure that the child's needs are being met. Now, that sounds Pollyanna, and I think that any cynic would be kind of correct in questioning, have we gotten it right every place that we meet the needs of children? We haven't gotten it right every place we meet the needs of children. But the fact that we are working toward getting it right is, I think, encouraging. And I do think that the RTI approach helps us, because what that says is special education and general education teachers must collaborate. The question is not so much where are we going to put the child, but how are we going to work as a team to meet that child's needs?
Yeah, Mary Ruth, my graduate work was in the area of inclusion. And, you know, inclusion is an idea or a philosophy that, you know, services are brought into the general classroom to the extent possible. And this really requires much more work, I think, than what we've been doing in terms of accepting and really inviting all different types of learners with all diverse needs into the classroom and really having an attitude that promotes that. Do you find that to be problematic?
Well, I do. And just putting a child with special needs in a general education classroom does not mean that child's included. Does not mean that that child's included within peer groups and that that child receives appropriate supports and interacts. In some cases, quote, inclusion means the child is just sort of sat in a corner. But when we think about the possibilities of full inclusion, and we think about how to structure classrooms so that children can be meaningfully engaged with other children and with material and with learning, that's what we have to strive for. And to say that it's not working in some places, so we should abandon the idea, I think would be giving up on children, because our children benefit, both children with special needs and typically developing children benefit from understanding that we all need support and we all need services. Now, the resources that you were bringing up, absolutely, Michelle, we have under-resourced and are not providing enough personnel and enough support and not reducing class sizes to a range that would allow a teacher to meaningfully include children with special needs.
Let me piggyback on that thought. What do you think needs to be done, and if you can give us any examples of what is being done to prepare the general ed teachers to work with these kids who are now being included?
Well, I think things like the Council for Exceptional Children's Professional Development Standards are really helpful, and we have standards that guide what a teacher, a general education teacher, and a special education teacher should know and be able to do. We need to ensure that when teachers are being prepared to teach, this coursework and this information is part of their preparation. We are losing vast numbers of teachers early on in their first 3 years.
Yep.
Our retention rate is just terrible, and I think that's a hot topic in and of itself that we can't really go into maybe today. But one of the key reasons that teachers say they can't stay is that they don't know how to meet the needs of the range of children who are in their classrooms today. So professional development, teacher preparation before they even get to the classroom, and then mentoring support and careful attention to giving the teacher the support that she or he needs to meet with success is critical. And we aren't there yet, but standards and higher education coursework specifically designed to help teachers learn the skills and knowledge that they need will, I think, be very useful.
And I think the other part of the equation is that when there are special educators in the room, which you talked about before,
absolutely,
the speech pathologist or the special educator who is supporting with reading or writing or other content,
yes,
what's happening to prepare them to work effectively in that inclusive environment versus the old model of when they had kids or may still have kids in a separate classroom.
That's right. And again, I mean, I hate to keep going back to RTI, but that is one of our themes today. And within that RTI, it specifies collaboration. So at Tier 1, the general classroom teacher is primarily responsible for providing quality education. At Tier 2, the special ed, the related service, the general ed work together to say, oh, my gosh, what else needs to be put in place so this child can be successful? And then at Tier 3, or sometimes in some models it's Tier 4, the specialists take the lead in saying, okay, now we need to make sure this child has very specialized, individualized supports and services. So inclusion should never be done in exclusive ways that undermine the individual education plans that are the legal and ethical right of children with exceptionalities.
Mary Ruth, you're bringing up a topic for me that I encounter all the time, and I think of Hudson versus Hudson. It was a precedent-setting case where the child in question was determined to be a, quote, island in the mainstream instead of, as you said, meaningfully included. And a lot of times school teams will argue for inclusion of a child with special needs because they say, the team says that the child can benefit from peer modeling, yet sometimes students with special needs don't have the skills to look around the classroom and really integrate what everyone else is doing into their own, I guess, internal set. Can you talk a little bit about peer modeling and how it's important in this conversation?
Well, I do think that children benefit from being in settings with a variety of kinds of individuals, and typically developing peers often do provide models in terms of speech language, socially appropriate behaviors, and other things. But we have to remember, they're kids in a classroom who are there to learn. They're not really, their goal of having that child in the classroom is not so they can be a model for another child. So we have to be, I think, a little wary of making huge placement decisions and academic and life shaping decisions based on what a child is going to get from a peer modeling situation. But it is true that children learn from each other. And in learning from each other, they benefit. Now, there are some children whose exceptionalities are pretty challenging, and it makes it difficult, perhaps, for them to observe, to see, to hear, to process, to understand what's going on with their peers just by being in the same room. For children with challenges like this, we have to be much more explicit and not just say, well, they're in the room, they should have noticed that children typically ask in this way or raise their hand or wash their hands before snack. We have to do explicit teaching and modeling and set up situations where kids can practice these kinds of skills and not leave it to chance. And much of that may need to be done outside the general classroom.
We're gonna pick back up right there after our break. Again, we encourage folks to call in, email in if you want to participate in this discussion. And we'll be back after the break with Dr. Mary Ruth Coleman. Before they can
die. Helping you make informed decisions for your life. This is Voice America Health and Wellness.
Life can be full of risks. One thing you shouldn't take a risk with ever is your family's health insurance. If you're self-employed or an individual and you need affordable health insurance, you need to make this free call right now and see how the Mega Life and Health Insurance Company can help you get it. We specialize in helping the self-employed and individuals just like you who need affordable health insurance to get it. So call us right now. 888-459-4825. 888-459-4825. 859-4825. Don't take a risk with your family's health insurance. It's not worth it. If you're self-employed or an individual and you need affordable health insurance, call us now and see how we can help you. 888-459-4825. 888-459-4825. 888-459-4825. Home office, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Not available in all states. Benefits may vary by state.
How can we be powerful advocates for the children in our lives? How do we ensure that they're getting the best education possible? The Special Needs Advocacy Training Institute prepares parents and educators to be outstanding advocates for school success. The Training Institute is based on Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis's Special Needs Advocacy Resource Book. The book is comprehensive, practical, and easy to read. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn more about this dynamic training opportunity. Parents, are you concerned with your child's progress at school? Educators, do you wish that you could do more for your class? Are you interested in pursuing a career in educational advocacy? At SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com, you'll learn how to make a difference in the lives of children. You will also find information about Rich and Michelle's consulting and advocacy services. Our children need powerful advocates to ensure that they're getting an appropriate education. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn what you can do to more effectively advocate for the children in your life.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Teach your children well.
You're listening to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education with hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or tip regarding today's topic, give us a call toll-free at 866-472-5792. That number again is 866-472-5792. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back. This is Rich Weinfeld along with Michelle Davis and our wonderful guest today, Dr. Mary Ruth Coleman. We've been talking in the last segment about inclusion, which is certainly a major theme throughout our country, including more and more special ed students within the general ed classroom. And we've been talking about the pros and some of the possible cons related to that. And Mary Ruth, one question I wanted to talk about, when school staff and parents focus on inclusion and make that a priority and talk about keeping kids in the least restrictive environment, I think sometimes we lose sight of part of the law, which also says that we must have a continuum of services, and that though we'd like kids to be included in the regular classroom, there are going to be some students who need a variety of other services. So I'd like you to speak to that, your thoughts about that.
Oh, I think that's a key point, Rich. I mean, inclusive environments are one setting. Whenever we think of the range of needs and the intensity of needs of students, we have to think multiple setting. The law requires it, but common sense dictates that we should understand that within any educational programming and any educational set of services, we need a continuum of options. And any given child may need a continuum of options to meet their own needs, let alone multiple children in a school. That continuum of options should include options and opportunities to engage to the best and fullest extent possible with typically developing children, but it must include options for explicit instruction, options for support and services outside of the general classroom, options for, all levels of special education supports and services, and the same for gifted and talented children. Children with gifts and talents need the same array of services and the same range of options and opportunities. So no single placement option is going to meet the needs of a child with exceptionalities, let alone groups of children with exceptionalities. And I think your point is well made. We have possibly the pendulum has swung toward full inclusion, and in that process we have lost some very strong supports and services that need to be in place for the teacher, the child, the parent, and everyone.
I get nervous when we talk about inclusion as a new trend and something that needs to be done to keep kids in the regular classroom.
Right.
It makes me think that, you know, many of the kids are in special ed because they couldn't make it in the regular classroom. Mm-hmm. So we need to do something different in order for them to be successful. Little soapbox there.
I think you're absolutely right, though. Get on that soapbox.
I'd like you to talk a little bit about No Child Left Behind, and if you want to talk in terms of position that Council for Exceptional Children has on it. I'd like to hear, you know, what the thoughts are about No Child Left Behind, how maybe it should be changed. Just give you kind of an open forum to talk about that.
Wow. Well, No Child Left Behind, by the way, is maybe many of your listeners do know, but some may not, is a huge law that is like 300-400 pages. I mean, it's 3,000-4,000 pages. It's a huge law that addresses children from school-age children. It used to be called the Elementary and Secondary Schools Education Act. And some of the things within No Child Left Behind that were strengthened, put in, or are relatively new to No Child Left Behind as a law include things like the use of accountability for students and looking at if students actually are learning and holding teachers accountable for teaching. Now, that in and of itself, I think, is a pretty good idea. And the idea that you might say, well, you know, if teachers are doing their job, shouldn't children be learning? And if children are learning, shouldn't we be able to test that and measure that? And if we find that they are not learning at a rate that we would predict, which would be their annual yearly progress, then we might say teachers aren't doing an appropriate job, an adequate job. So that train of thought, once it's left the station, essentially says that we will measure teachers' ability and teachers' efficacy, or their success, if you will, by how their students do.
You know, Mary Ruth, I see in the Oregonian here newspaper, the National Teacher of the Year, Michael, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Geisen, was honored at the White House and took the opportunity while speaking with President Bush to turn to him and quote, tactfully suggest that the president rethink his landmark No Child Left Behind Act. Geisen is concerned that No Child Left Behind can censor innovative teachers like himself because of its heavy reliance on tests to track achievement and rate schools. So,
how would you like to see the next president, whoever that may be, change No Child Left Behind?
Well, what I would like to see is when you enter that train of thought, how's the child doing, and we take a look at how the child is learning, I would love us to be able to use things called growth modeling. Now, I'm not going to go off on some heavy statistical tangent here because I'll get above my head very quickly as well. But growth modeling essentially looks at where children start as well as where they finish in the course of a year. Instead of just saying, how do they do on any given test, it actually looks at children's growth throughout the year. That would be much more helpful to us than a single point, well, here is how this child did right now. They either made it or didn't make it on one test measure. None of us would like to be evaluated on one data point. And I don't even care if you say to me, you can pick the data point that we're going to judge you on, Mary Ruth. You tell us whatever you want, and we'll judge you on that one data point. I'd be like, well, you won't get a comprehensive picture, and you won't really know what my strengths are, but you also won't know what my challenges are. So doing away with that single data point that is the, quote, end of year or annual yearly progress is measured on that test score for a child is a very good starting place, and going to growth curves and growth modeling. Another thing that I think we need to be thinking about is ways that we can use progress monitoring. Teachers are getting much better at monitoring the progress for children throughout the year, very systematically and very carefully and formally. We are asking within the reauthorization that when teachers do quality progress monitoring for children, especially children with disabilities, who may need an alternative assessment, that progress monitoring data be able to document the student's growth so that if they are not able to come up to the typical child's annual yearly progress growth on a test, the progress monitoring data can be used to document the growth. I think taking a look also at ways that we support teachers to be better able to meet their children's needs is equally as important than, and perhaps more so, than just saying we're going to look at one test and how your kids did on that one test and make huge decisions about the teacher, the school, and even the child. We're making life-changing decisions about children in some cases based on one data point.
Rich?
Mary Ruth, we want to give you a chance to talk briefly about Councils for Exceptional Children, any upcoming initiatives that you'd like to make people aware of as we get ready to go to our close.
Yes, and Mary Ruth, I apologize. I neglected to mention that you're past president of Council for Exceptional Children, so please feel free.
Well, I am past president. I think that's the operative phrase. So I don't really speak on behalf of the council at this point. Dr. Susan Fowler is our current president, and you may wish to have her on as a guest on your show. She's wonderful and an expert in early childhood, among other things. But the council is very active in the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind. And in this reauthorization, the council really is focused on how do we ensure that the needs of children with exceptionalities are addressed and that it's not a one-size-fits-all law anymore. And as we do that, we're also thinking about how bright children's needs can be assessed and looked at. So we're very active in reauthorization that's going on, and I think the council has many, many position papers and things on the website that your listeners might want to go to.
Mary Ruth, thank you so much for being with us. Wealth of great information. Next week, we're going to have Carol Ann Tomlinson with us to talk about an ideal classroom, the characteristics of an outstanding class, and how to differentiate for the different students within that class. Thanks for being with us today. See you next week.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's edition of Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education. Join your hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis again next Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, 12 noon Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Teach your children well. Their father's health did slowly go by, and feed them on your dream, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh, and know they love you.